Alrighty, good morning everybody. It is the 9th of July and we are live this morning from Johannesburg and bringing you all kinds of information and useless frivolity as well. But we do have a guest today, which I'm excited about. Somebody we've been actually trying to get into the studio for at least a couple of weeks, maybe even a couple of months. He's no stranger to the show though, he's been on before. He is Joe Emilio, who I can say, hey Joe.
Hello, how are you?
Waving stupidly at the camera. What do you think this is, the Teletubbies?
Hi!
God. All right, now you can add to your list of job titles because you've done a lot. I mean, comedian, you've performed on top stages, Cape Town Comedy Festival, Cape Town Comedy Club, Rock and Run Fest, Namibia. So yep. It's international. You were born in Texas, though.
Yep.
You were raised in Egypt,
yep.
Which for people is a very strange place to find yourself after being born in Texas. And then you find yourself even more strange in Cape Town.
Yeah.
But you're also going to add the term documentary maker now, or the job description of documentary maker to your list of things in your CV. I was very impressed. I watched your documentary Stolen Land,
yeah.
Which we'll get into in a short while. I think for a lot of people, this is where the rubber meets the road in terms of like, land seizures, expropriation, yes. Without compensation, so many of the issues that we worry about,
yes.
In South Africa. Because what is the point of working and having property if they can just take it away from you?
100%.
Or if it can just be undermined while you're on top of it.
Exactly. And it's happening right now as we speak.
And I think we'll get into how you got into being a documentary maker, because that's a whole different world. And it really is just a quality documentary. I encourage anyone to watch it.
Thank you.
It doesn't have to cost you as the viewer anything, there's a lot of work in there. And I see the comment section's full of all kinds of comments already. Lots of good mornings from a fresh Pretoria, from Barely Vocal Media. Listen, it was pretty cold this morning, but by no means what it has been. I was like, I got out of the shower this morning and I thought, oh, they're not so bad. am I losing it?
Maybe okay. Being climatized it, you know?
Maybe, but I also almost fell up the stairs when I was coming up here just now. No, it's very embarrassing. On that first flight of stairs, you know where you kind of, you just get a little ahead of yourself?
Yeah.
And you very nearly face-plant into the step, which would have been just delightful. Can you imagine me with like teeth missing? And,
well, but that would just show your commitment to the show, right?
Yeah, I'd look like I'd been assaulted by Mike Tyson, but I don't think it would have been a good show. People would have watched to feel sorry for me or to laugh at me,
or that,
but either way. All right, so we got a lot to talk about this morning. There's plenty in the news as well, and we'll get to all of that in a short while. So first things first, like how did you decide this was the subject that you were going to make a documentary on? I mean, if someone gave me a budget, which you didn't have, you had to pay for this yourself.
Yeah.
And they said, go and make a documentary about anything. I don't think that the Tigerberg Raceway would have been in my top 5 million. You know? How did this come up?
Wait, now I'm curious. What would you have done?
I don't know. I probably would have gone to Egypt or something. But
okay.
But what brought you to the subject and how are you connected to it? Because it seems to me like a very, very strange thing to put the amount of effort that you did into this. Not that I'm complaining, otherwise we wouldn't, all of us would have been none the wiser. But,
yeah.
But what is it that drew you to the subject?
Well, it's really not an exciting story.
No, it is. So basically, I think it is an exciting story.
Well, what happened was basically there's a guy on X by the name, his name on X is LP. And he did an awesome thread of all these little dorpies and all these little cities and towns and areas around the Western Cape and some in South Africa that show, he shows, for example, satellite image of like 2000 and it's nice and greenery, it's a nice neighborhood. And then he shows later, like in 2020 or whatever, how townships have just taken over. And right. It's all these different kinds of cities and towns and dorpies and all that stuff. So I did a story on that. On my YouTube channel, and
of course now you can do that. Anyone can do this. You go on Google Earth, and you can use the history tab,
yes, exactly,
to look back at the last 15, 20 years.
And it's actually quite scary, actually.
It is. You know what's scary about it is that first of all, that migration is usually out of desperation. So wherever they've come from is probably worse. But that's not really my concern, because I don't see why I should be the compassion police.
No.
What it is to me is it's a degradation of that property, of 100%. That land. It goes from being often open green land, mm-hmm. which is owned by somebody and either used as pasture for animals, or it's farmland, or it's open land where there could be developments that mm-hmm. could house people properly, but instead it's overtaken by squatters, which is something we've been dealing with in this country since like 1990-something.
1998. And but that's what made me so curious, right? So I'm looking at all this whole thread, and I'm like, how is it so easy? How is it even allowed in the so-called constitutional democracy that this can happen, right?
Right.
So that's where my curiosity peaked. And I said on the show, or on that episode, I said, if you guys want me to do a more deep dive into this, let me know and I'll do it. And then I got a phone call from a friend, Clay Wilson, who was like, dude, you got to do something. You got to do like a 20-minute segment on it. We got to dig deeper into this. And so the original idea was to look at the Tigerberg Raceway, Grabau, and Hermanus. Mm-hmm. But I quickly realized that, as you mentioned, I don't have a budget, that's not going to be possible. Accommodation and safety concerns and stuff like that. So I decided, okay, let me focus on the Tigerberg Raceway, because I actually don't live too far from it. It's a 15-minute drive from where I am. And find out who's still around that I can possibly interview and ask questions. So like, for example, Chris Liebenberg, the former owner, I didn't know if he was still alive. I don't know if he's still in South Africa. I didn't know. So Clay actually tracked him down. And luckily, Chris was very willing to tell his story. I mean, if he wasn't willing to, I don't know if it would have been as impactful. Then I quickly realized that, okay, this is a bigger story than I thought it was going to be. Let me see if I can make a documentary out of this, because I think the Tigerberg Raceway story needs to be told, and it's a big story, and I want to give Chris a voice, his family a voice, the fans of racing and
okay, so let's talk on that note about Tigerberg Raceway. So what was this place in its heyday, and who would go there, and what was the main activity, and how long ago was it still running?
Yes.
To most people's knowledge, before it started to fall apart.
It was running right up until COVID, right until lockdown. And obviously, the lockdown shut down everything. But before that, it was booming. You had young racers of all ages that could, if they were old enough to drive, they could go in this. It's an oval race, dirt raceway. Right. So it was a community raceway. Mm-hmm. So a lot of young starting out racers would start there. They might go on to like circuit racing or something else. But that's where they got their, they basically practiced, like a comedian going to open mic nights. That's where we practice. And it's the same for these guys. That's where they practice, that's where they got their skills and all that stuff. And in the documentary, Gary, one of the motorsport commentary guys, who's also an encyclopedia for motor racing in South Africa, explained that it's not just for the racers. You know, when you have this event, it's vendors, security, mm-hmm. The whole community gets involved.
It's a business. And it's a reason for people to go out and do something.
Yeah, and
Chris, which people are desperate for.
Exactly. And Chris was also saying that he used to hire people in the nearby community, to do car guard or to work as an usher or gatekeeper, mm-hmm. whatever you want to. He would give those people jobs, which we all know is scarce. So now that this raceway is gone, there's so many people who are actually unemployed. And something that Gary mentioned as well is that when you have this raceway, and it's a good one, people want to support it, people will buy cars, like they'll build their own cars, which is a whole nother industry on its own with other jobs and stuff like that. So now that this raceway is gone, there's a lot of people that are unemployed because of it. So that's basically how this raceway was so important to the community. And I felt that was also important to show in the documentary because, other land grabs are maybe on empty farmland or empty municipal land or whatever. But this
but we
was,
lost something of value.
Yes.
All right. So tell me how it went wrong, because I want people to watch the documentary instead of just hear the story here. But you're going to want to actually see, because there's amazing the interviews that you're talking about now, you can actually see what it looked like before, what it looked like, what it looks like now, and how it all happened. But just explain to us where it all went wrong. You said it wasn't even that long ago. It's like 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, 5 years ago. So basically what happened was there was a protest in the area, Blukenbos, next to the raceway. And that protest escalated very quickly. And
what were they protesting?
Apparently they were removed from housing. They were removed from – some shacks were taken down in Blukenbos.
So in other words, they were already illegally occupying land.
Yes.
And then someone took those down and then they complained.
They were like, okay, well, we're going to take everything now. That's kind of like the attitude they had. And they invaded the raceway. They tore it down. And obviously the city, the police, J.P. Smith did try and intervene. But during lockdown, the courts weren't allowed to evict. There was a regulation that said the courts are not allowed to evict people. So what happened was the city had to try and get an interdict to basically say, hey, listen, this is like land that is being taken over. We need to get these people off of it. It's not right.
And where are these people from? And I mean, where do they – have they always been in that area?
Yes.
Have they come in from neighboring areas? Is there work for them there? Is there something for them to do there? Do they have some claim to it in some
those are questions I
indirect way, shape, or form?
Yeah, those are questions I wanted to ask, but it would have been too dangerous for me to.
Yeah, you couldn't actually ask these squatters what they were
doing. Yeah, because I couldn't go in, or I'd be a target, so I couldn't go into the township.
So it's also a lovely neighborhood.
Yeah, very lovely.
Which is great.
Great scenery.
As is usually the case.
Yes.
The shame. But these poor people, they don't know where, they have nowhere to live. And then within finding a place to live, within moments of that, it becomes an absolute shithole for everyone concerned.
But one thing I want to mention is just to go back a bit, is so when the city applied for that interdict, the South African Human Rights Commission got involved and stopped the city.
Of course, those cretinous assholes at the Human Rights Commission wouldn't have got involved. Those people,
and that's how it happened, because once they stopped the interdict, it was open season.
They have some nerve. I mean, they get involved in every issue we don't need them involved in, and none of the ones we do.
Yeah. And ironically, actually protecting the guy that actually needs to be protected.
I mean, the only rights that I can see that are being in any way gainsaid here are the rights of the guy who owns the property.
Exactly. 100%. And they didn't care. They're like, no, shame. These people need a place to stay. You can't evict them because the regulations say you're not allowed to evict.
So then by the same rationale, I mean, like if you've got an empty bedroom at home, and there have been people who've said this before. I mean, I think Julius Malema has said it. And, you know, really, really uneducated, ignorant, and dumb people will say, well, you've got an empty bedroom at home. You should just take on a homeless person and let them live in your house.
Yeah.
I mean, there is so much wrong with you if you think that that's a solution to our problems.
No, it's not.
But anyway, I mean, some people just don't think property rights are important. Yeah. And tell me why you think they are, because it seems to me that there's a cut and dried case of this property belonged to someone. There was a business there. There was a community that was involved and very much invested in that place. It was something to be proud of for that area.
No, 100%.
And it's now completely gone, subsumed by shacks and raw sewage and people who are impoverished and stealing from each other within their own community as quickly as they stole from the guy who owns the land.
Yep. And I spoke to a lady who's quite involved with townships and stuff like that, and she actually went on the ground and she asked like where these people come from, and a lot of them were saying that they're not from the Western Cape.
Oh, I mean, this is Helen Ziller's old thing of economic refugees,
which caused
huge trouble. Do you remember what noise there was around that?
Yeah. But they're all also speaking.
Yeah, that's, okay. Yeah. So they probably come from that even worse province, the Eastern Cape, which, by the way, has been run. I mean, people say run like a spaza shop, but people run spaza shops properly. Like the Eastern Cape. No, they do. I mean, a spaza shop is a well-run business. It's got very tight margins. You have to know exactly how much stock you have. You have to know what you're selling and how much, and prices change all the time. And you really have to have your eyes, you know, on everything when you're running a business like that. But the Eastern Cape is run by some of the worst people in South Africa who just have absolutely no skills. that province, we may as well just cut along the border and let it sink into the sea. It is just a disgrace.
Yeah.
And so everyone's getting out while they can. And where are they going? Well, they're going to where there are economic opportunities. And where are their economic opportunities? In the better run places and the places where there are businesses that need employees. And frankly, I don't know who would hire anyone from the Eastern Cape because they're just all useless. But that's just me.
But there is another part to it.
So no, but hang on. I want to make this point because there was a huge internet sensation when Helen Ziller said, as a matter of now undisputed fact, that the Eastern Cape was the source of so many of these people who are living in the townships in and around Cape Town, who are recent, like first-generation migrants to Cape Town, and they're coming there because they're trying to find work, which is fine. But the word for that is economic refugee. Mm. And she was pilloried by the left in this country and by other political parties who said, oh, how can you call them refugees? It's within your own country. Well, you can be a refugee from Johannesburg to somewhere else if you were chased out of Johannesburg. And if your current circumstances are such that you cannot find meaningful and gainful employment and you seek that somewhere else, technically you're an economic refugee or migrant. Mm. So I don't know why everyone was so super upset and sensitive about that. But then I suppose people on the left are sensitive about words because they twist them and they only want the right to twist them for themselves.
Well, look what they did to Jack Miller recently. Basically said the same thing Helen Ziller said.
Right.
That he was literally removed from the city council in Cape Town, which was also, he didn't say anything wrong. He just said economic migrants.
I mean, I don't think if you were rich and you left Johannesburg for Cape Town, you'd be protesting if someone called you an economic migrant or refugee. You'd probably laugh.
Yeah.
But I love these people who are upset on behalf of the people who don't give a shit what you call them.
Exactly.
Pretending that they have some kind of moral indignation, that they're seriously upset. I mean, deep down inside, you can tell they know they're lying.
Exactly.
So enough about that. All right. Anyway, we digress. So you go in here, you ask these people, well, you didn't, but you had someone who went in and asked these people who are there, what is the current situation on the ground? I mean, you made the documentary quite recently, so you still have fresh eyes and ears on the scene, and now people are going to want updates.
Yes.
So I'm sure you're keeping an eye now.
Well, I mean, nothing's changed. You know, when there's still the townships there, people are living, because this is the one thing that is interesting in the documentary. Chris mentions that
there's a lot of things that are interesting. Yeah. In the
documentary. Chris mentions that the land was earmarked for housing, but he proved to the city that the land isn't good for housing because the water level's too high.
Right.
When I asked the city about that, they said, no, we had our guys go and inspect the land and they thought it was great. They thought it was good for land, for housing. So two different stories, but I believe Chris Moore, because there's footage in the documentary of a guy standing in the middle of the raceway now with all these shacks that are erected and the water, you can see it. And it's not raining. It's like a nice day. And the water is just up there. People are literally, the shack is in ankle deep water. This is what people are living in.
Every time we have floods in this country and every time there's just a little bit too much rain, there are people who drown and people whose houses are washed away. You know, we have, I mean, it's amazing. I don't know about you. I've built my house, right?
Okay.
When you build your own house in South Africa, you have to go through something called the NHBRC.
Yes.
Right? So you have to go to some place where there's a bunch of bureaucrats and you have to have them stamp your plans and then they're allowed to come and inspect while you're building. And then they will check every little nook and cranny. They will fine you. I don't know what happens to that fine money, whose pockets it goes to. But this is an actual organization that is there to make sure that people don't build. I suppose the idea originally was that you don't build a house that's going to fall in on you and kill you and cause trouble for your neighbors and upset the water underneath it in the ground, or you know, empty its sewage directly into rivers.
Yes.
But if you want to build a shack, no one tells you to do anything or not to do anything. It's almost as if, once you decide you're going to live in absolute squalor, no rules apply to you.
Well, that's because of the Pi Act.
Well, explain this Pi Act, because this is an important part of the story too.
So the PIE Act, which is the prevention of illegal evictions for illegal squatters, basically, which is an oxymoron. So basically what this act says is that, let's say you went away, okay? Yeah. I managed to jump over your fence. I set up a tent. I put like a makeshift bed and a suitcase and whatever. You come back from holiday. Whether I'm there or not, you're not allowed to remove that tent. And if you do, that law says that you have to reimburse me. You have to put the tent back up. And if you want to remove me, you have to provide alternative accommodation. That's what's written in that law.
This is ludicrous.
Yeah.
And this is the most stupid law.
When
did this become a law, and how come most of us probably go through our lives never having to encounter it?
Okay, so the reason why I think a lot of people don't know about it is because of media not reporting on it. Mm. That's the first thing. Second thing is this law came into effect in 1998.
I mean, there is nobody, even the most basic rural person in the backwaters of South Africa who's never learned to spell or add or subtract, even they know the idea that if someone comes and squats on your property, you should be able to get rid of them.
Yeah.
That seems to me to be, even primitive man would have known that if some wild animal comes and makes its home in his cave, he has the right to kill that animal in order to get his cave back. I mean, it seems to me that this is basic.
Much like we were discussing earlier about certain regulations and laws that come into play because it's supposed to be like for a good cause.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with the PIE Act. The PIE Act was supposed to be to protect the vulnerable, which are women and children, so that you can't just evict them and leave them on the streets helpless. And also to prevent apartheid era evictions that used to happen and stuff like that, which is true. It did happen. So that was the good Samaritan kind of vibe that they were trying to sell this act on. But the problem is it's very, very vague on a lot. Mm-hmm. It doesn't even define what a home is. J.P. Smith mentions that if so much of a tarp is over your head and you've got a toothbrush or whatever next to you, that's deemed a home. You cannot remove it. That's why they have so much problems with the homeless in Cape Town and stuff like that,
because
you just can't remove them. Same thing with the castle and all that stuff. So
Which looks like shit, by the way.
Yeah,
this is the first permanent human habitation in the south of Africa.
Yeah,
it was built in 1652 by the original settlers there.
Yeah,
a stone structure, the first stone structure with like. ramparts and all the rest of it. And it is now completely surrounded by disgusting tents and homeless shelters and squatter shacks. Mm. And
they fixed it recently.
It's revolting. I mean, it's just revolting. Years. I walked in there with a friend of mine because I thought, like, let's go and see the castle. This is the first building that made Cape Town, Cape Town, right?
Yep.
You don't want to go there. Don't waste your time. It is hugely unsafe. It smells like shit because there's literally shit everywhere. And it is just an absolutely perfect symbol of how this government of ours have run everything into the ground and pulled it through their backsides.
Yeah. And also, like with the PIE Act, I think the most insane thing is that what it says is if you want to remove that person, you have to do it immediately. So in other words, you would have had to have been home. You would have had to have seen me jump over that fence with a tent and then come out, call the police, go immediately to the courts, get that eviction as soon as possible, stop me from putting up the tent, all immediately. If you fail, if I put up that tent, even if I'm not in it, even if there's just an empty suitcase, you're not allowed to remove it. That's how absurd this law is. And it forces you to go to the courts, which end up costing you, the property owner, millions of rands, because we all know how the court system works in this country. It takes years for you to get any kind of progress.
Yeah.
And the majority of people, whether it be municipal or private or whatever, give up. They just give up because it's like nothing's getting done. Nothing's moving along. And if the people who put up this shack or tent or what have you on your property happen to be women and children, forget about evicting them. The court will sympathize with them, and so they get to live on your land forever using.
So then, I mean, by that rationale, and I believe everything you're saying because you've looked into this with far greater detail and expertise than I have. By that rationale, who the hell wants the land? I certainly don't. I don't want any property if that's what could happen to your property. If someone can come and erect some tarpaulin over them and their three screaming children, live in your garden, and suddenly it's your problem?
Yep.
Forevermore?
Yep.
Who wants the... Guys, you know what? I've decided I don't want the land.
Julius, did you hear that?
Come, it doesn't sound like a good investment.
Come take the land.
Well, I used to have... three properties, right? I'm down to one, the one I live in.
Yeah.
And even that, I'm starting to think, fuck it, maybe these Gen Z kids have got it right. Like, just rent. Like, why own a property? It's so much maintenance. It's so much work. Now you tell me that you can have squatters come and live there. And
it's even worse.
No way to get rid of them.
It gets worse because of the Expropriation Act. So in the Expropriation Act, there are three or four clauses that state when the government...
This is the new Expropriation Act, which they passed last year.
Yes. Which allows for nil compensation. So there's like three or four conditions that allow for expropriation without compensation. Before they list those four reasons or exceptions or whatever you want to call it, they say, the government can take your land without compensation for the following reasons, but not limited to, which is a very, very...
So we can add more reasons if we want.
And they use vague terms like public interest, which is...
Sure. I mean, the public interest could be that Paul Mashatile's cousin runs the lottery and he needs an office. Really?
But if you look at the raceway as an example, and this is something I mentioned in the documentary, all right, what stops the government from looking at that piece of land, realizing that the land's been abandoned, because that's one of the conditions, although there is a clause in there or a caveat that... If the land is abandoned and you can prove that you're still trying to fight for it in court or what have you, the government won't take it. But if you're not actively trying to get the land back...
So if you've just given up...
Yeah, the government can come in and say, oh, well, you abandoned it. This is now a human rights violation and a crisis and blah, blah. We're going to take the land without compensation. They can do that. I'm not saying they will, but they can.
Oh, trust me. Wherever the government has the can, they'll turn it into a will.
Well, look what they're doing with Johannesburg, the hijacked buildings. Same
Correct.
Thing.
Correct. Yeah.
Same thing.
You see them snapping those up. Those used to belong to people who were able once to charge other people to live in them. And now they're squalid and often completely run down, broken skeletons of what used to be buildings.
But again, the people that live in those buildings now, yeah, some of them were hijacked by syndicates and other things, but the people that live there, they're protected by the PI Act. That's why they can't be removed.
And lots of illegal immigrants.
Yes.
Okay, so what's the situation for the guy who used to own the Tigerberg Raceway? I mean, what are his chances of getting that back? And
no chances.
There's no chance.
Because I asked the city.
It's lost.
I did
forever.
Ask the city if they have any plans to rectify the situation or solutions or anything.
By the way, this is a DA-run city, so let's not think that it's just the ANC who can't or won't do anything when squatters pitch up and just take property that isn't theirs. But this is the DA municipality of Cape Town.
Yes. And when I asked the city, they basically said, we've looked at options, but we haven't made a decision. And I was like, well, if you haven't made a decision in 5 years, you're not going to.
They're never going to.
Yeah.
It's not a priority to them.
No.
Have you heard, since you've released the documentary, about new interest and renewed pressure? And certainly this is going to get a lot of people's feathers ruffled. There are going to be plenty of people who are not happy that you made this documentary.
So far, actually, everybody's been quite positive about the documentary, even lefty ones. But I think a lot of people can see that, short of maybe doing a back-a-buddy for Chris to maybe open a new raceway, the city and everybody else is just raising their hands saying, it's done, it's over, it's finished. You can't even if you were to remove those people from that land. I think that land is so messed up now.
Yeah, I don't think
you can do anything with it. So it's gone. It's gone. And the biggest injustice is the fact that Chris lost, as he claims this, 60 million rand building that raceway. And hasn't been compensated for it.
Listen, even if he lost 1 million rand, it's his million rand that he put in.
And the city hasn't even... Because there was a conversation for him to open. The city was going to give him another piece of land somewhere and he could reopen and stuff like that. at the beginning they were talking to him about it, and then they just went quiet and they haven't reignited that conversation. And I hope now that conversation gets reignited, but I don't know if Chris is going to trust them. And how could you? Even in their contract with the city actually has a clause in there that says Chris is responsible for protecting that land, and that if a land invasion does happen, he has to pay to get that sorted. And whatever that, like, if there's any damages, so he has to pay for it.
He would have to pay for them to be removed.
Yes,
he'd have to prevent further invasions.
The city takes no responsibility.
So by the way,
which is unfair.
In your research around what this means for ordinary South Africans, what can you, as a landowner, do in South Africa? What are the limits of your rights to defend and protect your property?
Yeah, you can defend your property. Every South African has a right to defend it, but you just have to be...
Can I set up gun turrets on every corner
You can set up, you know, we have private security, you've got like fencing, all that stuff, all that stuff deters someone.
Can I do pits with crocodiles in them?
You can do that, yeah.
And stakes that are sharpened at one end.
Yeah.
I can do all that?
You can do it. You can even put landmines
in the area.
Okay, this
is getting more exciting. I might want to hold on to the land after all.
Put some booby traps somewhere,
sure.
You know.
Yeah.
Because let me tell you, if a person still manages to get all through, yeah.
Can I plant mines and put them
and
there with
them? And if they manage to get through all that, I say, let them have it.
Well, it'll be a fun game to see them get through it, right? So you're allowed to defend your property, but if someone does make it through and they set up their shitty little fucking shack, then that's your, then from there on.
That's your reward. Well done, you won. You beat the game.
Wow. Okay. That's,
yeah,
that's
you can protect your land, of course. You can put up security cameras and all that stuff, have panic buttons so that the private security can come immediately. All that stuff, you are entitled to protect your land. The only problem comes in when someone either erects a shack or some kind of what is deemed a home on your property.
Again, you say it's very vague to define a home.
Yes.
Because to me... you know, a hovel, some kind of basic shelter.
Exactly, would be deemed a home. Even if it's a cardboard box, you know.
Unbelievable.
Cardboard box is
a home.
Yeah.
Wow, we really treat people like absolute shit in this country. But we define home so broadly because we don't upset anybody and shame poor them, they're vulnerable. The cardboard box is actually defined as a home. What kind of people are we?
And so that's the only part where it becomes an issue for the property owner is if someone's able to set up a shelter, and then it becomes a whole process. That's what the PI Act does. But if someone's just trespassing on your property, hasn't set up anything, is just walking by, you are allowed to protect yourself. You're allowed to do something about it.
Well, I wish you all the best of luck with this documentary, because I think everybody should see it. It's called Stolen Ground, the Tygerberg Raceway Story. And it will give you a hell of a lot of insight into just how the ANC has eroded property rights in this country. So there it is. There's the information you need. Where can people get it? On YouTube?
Yeah, on my YouTube channel. Yeah.
Very good. And look up Joe Emilio on YouTube and on all his social media to find out all the links.
Yeah. And also www.stolenground.co.za. So there's a website for it.
Awesome.
And you can see all the information there and stuff like that. And I will hopefully make another one, but
yeah.
I do need this one, as we discussed, is
What did it cost you?
A lot of time and sacrifice, family time.
You just went, like it's like you're someone who's dying inside. You're like, it cost me my happiness, my joy, all the dignity, all the
listen,
pleasure
a lot of effort
life.
Went into this, okay, and a lot of late night editing.
And you did all of that yourself.
All of it myself.
That's phenomenal, man. Listen, congratulations. I really love that. I mean, I've been talking to you for years, and we've known each other a little bit, but I had no idea you were this kind of documentary filmmaker. It's very good stuff.
I didn't know either.
So, all right, let's talk about some other news, because I want your take on a couple of things. So apparently we've got a 30% plus a 10%. So I wasn't wrong on Monday when I told you that we've got a 40% trade tariff heading our way on the 1st of August from the United States. Of course, our president, Cyril Ramaphosa, this week, by the way, he's had a terrible week because he's been asked two whole questions. Our president is not used to having any questions at all. Most of us don't even really pay attention to whether he's in the country, out of the country, whether he says anything or doesn't say anything. But this week, we needed him to respond to two important things. The first one was General Mkhwanazi in KwaZulu-Natal, who's the police commissioner there, who said that there are some very, very serious problems with corruption and fraud and some huge finger-pointing going on in the police, something that the president can't ignore. So he made this kind of half-assed attempt to answer the question. Did you see it? He goes, who is that? Oh, General Mkhwanazi, yeah. Got the energy of a deflated football, guy. I mean, he could just see, I don't know whether he even wants the job anymore. He's probably sitting there thinking, I got my billions out of mostly U.S. companies that I was given BE shares in when they came here, like McDonald's. I should just take that money and just go and live on my buffalo farm and spend all the money in my sofa.
Yeah,
I could have a very nice life. But here he is being asked questions, difficult questions by the media, like, what are you going to do about the fact that no one trusts the police, not even your own commissioners?
Mm.
And he's like, well, I'll answer those questions when I get back from BRICS, because everyone at BRICS is just waiting for him to arrive. They can't make a decision without him. In fact, they probably started the BRICS meeting before his plane had even landed. I'm sure Brazil, Russia, India, and China were sitting around already talking about the adult stuff, and then Cyril walks into the room, and they're like,
this guy.
Yeah, come here. We kept the chair. They pull up like a plastic garden chair for him.
Here's your begging bowl here. We're now
going to
use it.
Yeah, I mean, like, can you add any? Oh, no, you want something. Okay. That's kind of what happens. Anyway, so that was the first thing he was asked. The second thing is he was asked about the U.S. trade tariff. And so he said, it's based on contested interpretations of the data, the trade data. He emphasized that most U.S. goods already enter South Africa duty-free and reaffirmed the country's commitment to diplomatic negotiations. Talks are ongoing, with South Africa awaiting a formal U.S. trade engagement template and pushing forward a framework deal addressing key concerns. Well, those concerns came through probably about 4 weeks, 5 weeks ago, maybe even longer. It was in the wake of the Cyril Trump meeting at the Oval Office, in which everybody got to see our president and delegation humiliated on live television because of things like kill the Boer, expropriation without compensation, a lot of these land issues that you're talking about in your documentary. So they made four conditions, and typically the media in this country did not tell us any of that, even though the information was available. And now Cyril's acting all surprised. He's like, well, what's the problem? He's always surprised, this guy. How did this happen? Why me? Why didn't you tell me? I had no warning.
I believe the words he uses is baffled.
There he is. Look at that face. He's like, oh my goodness. What could it be? What is this? What a surprise. He's the one who's like in the Teletubbies. He's like that baby who goes, wah, at the beginning of the fucking show. It's unbelievable. This guy's in charge of the country? All right. Anyway, I think he's at this point, I'm starting to question whether he's even in charge of his own.
No, I've always said he's the spokesperson of ANC. That's it.
Yeah,
he's not a real leader.
So what do you think of the trade tariffs? Because we know what's going to happen here is that people who are going to try to defend this government at all costs, i.e. the mainstream media, are going to say, and I can predict this now, so write it down and you'll go, oh, okay, he was right. They're all going to say, oh, the mean US is being mean to South Africa, and it's not Cyril's fault that everything is going to cost the people of South Africa a whole lot more, and it's going to drive our economy into the dumpster. They're going to blame Donald Trump and the United States, even though the things that Trump and the United States were asking for were not unreasonable things. Things like, maybe you shouldn't have people running around your country saying, kill anybody. How about that? That would be quite straightforward and simple. How about that you just prioritize with the police, who you can't seem to get a handle on in any case, you just tell the U.S. we're going to prioritize farm murders. Not a difficult thing to do. It clearly worries the United States. And if you don't want a 40% tariff on everything, do it. Do you know how many South African businesses rely on the most important market in the world, the US? Why are you punishing them and punishing the GDP of our country? And the other thing was to stop expropriation without compensation, which, as we discussed for the first half hour of the show, you can go back and listen. It's kind of an important thing that you have the right to defend your property and that you have the right to actually hold and own your own property. Otherwise, what's the point of working? Why have property? Yep. And the fourth thing, which I always forget, what was the fourth thing, James? You did send it to me. Anyway, I always forget that fourth thing, but it also wasn't like the most insanely difficult thing for anyone to be able to do. Yeah, condemnation of Kildeboer we've had. What's the other one? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, BEE. Yeah, which, of course, has helped so many people in South Africa, i.e. Friends of Cyril's and people in the ANC who keep being helped. I mean, we just heard the other day, I jokingly said, Paul Mashatile's family are in charge of the national lottery now. This is happening now, by the way, as if Paul and all of his friends and family haven't already been appointed, I don't know, directors, shareholders, tenderpreneurs involved in every kind of government business there is available. Didi Mabuza, who died last week, our former deputy president, hand in the till, guys. Yeah. So can we stop with this facade of BEE like it's meant to help? Like the broad-based black economy, it isn't. I don't know anyone who's running a small business in South Africa who's been helped by BEE. Do you?
Nope.
No, it's just – and then, of course, your big companies just go and they do some fronting, window dressing. They find someone who's politically connected. They never find just someone who they already know or work with. And they put them up front to just fulfill those quotas. So all that ends up happening is no value is created. And I don't think that those four conditions are conditions that the average South African would have a problem seeing implemented. Yeah. So when we get punished with these tariffs, which we're going to do, and the media are going to howl and say it's so unfair and Donald Trump's so mean and the Americans are horrible and this is all – we're just victims, don't believe a word of it. What do you think is going to happen?
I agree with you 100%. And I think like what's even worse is like the mainstream media who try and defend, you know, the BE and the killing of the Boer and blah, blah. Like they try and always, you know, explain it away. And like, what's his name? Adrian Besson from News 24 says Cyril was majestic. And that's not what he meant when he said kill the Boer and, you know, all this other stuff.
They explain it away until they can't anymore. Yeah. And then they suddenly go, oh, we never said that.
Exactly. So I think yeah, it's what America asked for South Africa to do is not out of the realm of like logic in terms of like it's simple, guys. This is just upholding, you know, a very normal way of life. You guys are going a little bit too overboard into the lefty communist kind of vibe, and you know, we're asking you to just tone it down and come back to, you know.
Like a world of rational, sensible,
yes,
middle-of-the-road policy where people at least know where they stand.
Exactly. And I think, listen, I know that the tariffs will probably hurt a lot of South Africans, but at the same time, it's about time someone kind of, you know, clapped Cyril a little bit, you know. Hey, buddy, come, you're doing the wrong thing.
The ANC is completely unused to this.
Well, they'll double down at the end of the day.
They probably will,
yeah.
Which will do even more damage. But I don't think that this government of ours, including all the GNU parties, I don't think they actually care about the average South African.
No, they don't.
They don't care about our own day-to-day struggles or the fact that everything is going up. Our petrol price just went up the other day. They're raising the electricity price again. These are all stealth taxes. These are not things that are making you more productive or adding to our base GDP. They're subtracting from that.
Yeah.
They are making the country less economically viable. And I don't know if you saw that graph that was put out just the other day. I think I shared it on Instagram. I'm going to try and find it for you quickly about the millionaire index.
No,
did you see that?
No.
It shows you where in the world millionaires and billionaires are going to.
Okay.
So the UK is losing, I mean, they're just losing a millionaire every other hour, if not minute.
Wow.
Let me just see if I can find this thing for you. This is fascinating. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, This is going to blow your mind. So there's this chart that they put out. It's called Millionaire Migration. Okay. So the UAE is attracting millionaires due to its low taxes, residency programs, and high-end lifestyle offerings. And of course, the fact that if you buy something there, whether it's property or anything else, it's yours.
Yeah.
Like basic free market economics, right?
Yeah.
So they've gained 9,800 millionaires and billionaires in the last year.
Wow.
And the country that's lost the most is the UK. They have lost 16,500 millionaires and billionaires in the UK. And the reason that they will lose the most millionaires due to sweeping tax changes and the closure of investor visas.
Ah,
so okay. Stupid UK. And Keir Starmer announced just last week, along with Rachel Reeves, who's the Chancellor of the Exchequer, they're going to be putting up taxes again.
Oy.
So when you tax people, what's important about this millionaire migration chart is that when you tax people who have the means to go or have the means to move their money, they will.
Yep.
They'll go somewhere else. So, okay, where do you think we fit on this list? Are we in the negative? Are we losing millionaires, or do you think we're gaining them?
I think we're losing.
Yes, we are. Not surprisingly, South Africa is in the negative side of this. We're actually quite close to the bottom. So the UK is losing. China is the next worst in terms of,
oh, that's interesting,
of bleeding millionaires. India, South Korea, Russia, Brazil, France. By the way, I just want to point out that's all the BRICS countries.
All the BRICS countries.
No one who has any money wants to be in Brazil, India, Russia, China.
For all you that say that the currency, the BRICS currency, is going to work.
Yeah, I don't know who's going to have it, but there it is. Okay, so UK, China, India, South Korea, Russia, Brazil, France, Spain, Germany, Israel, Vietnam, and then South Africa. We have apparently lost 250 millionaires in the last year, which we can ill afford. Yeah. I don't think there are that many in South Africa to start off with.
And what people also need to realize is, like, when you lose millionaires who are investing into the country and all that stuff, you're losing jobs. Because these are people who probably own businesses.
So, I mean, I know people hate the rich, right?
Yeah.
And most people look at rich people and they go, well, I'm just jealous of what they have, so yes, I hate them. But what you got to realize about rich people is that, first of all, they have the money to spend, which is good for people who are selling stuff in
exactly
the country.
Yes.
Otherwise, if they move to Miami or whatever, they're going to start buying things there. And guess what? Your little shop isn't going to get their business.
Mm-hmm.
And usually for millionaires, that includes cars and houses and the more expensive stuff that the rest of us can't afford.
Mm-hmm.
So if you run a luxury goods store, you don't want to lose millionaires. You want them to stay. That's their spending. Then, of course, there's what they do in the economy, which is they had to have become millionaires somehow, and it wasn't all by knowing Cyril and being in BEE.
Or having a good Bitcoin break.
Exactly. In order to get there, they've obviously made some decisions, which makes them possible employers,
mm-hmm,
possible business owners, possible financial gurus of some shape or form, and we need as many of those as we can get. They also then have to pay taxes. So the government loses when they leave because they stop paying tax here, which means we can't build the bridges and schools and roads and the electrical infrastructure that we need because we're making less money as a country. So you don't want to lose these people. The countries that are doing well, which I'm kind of interested in, UAE, I mentioned them already. People are moving to Dubai. You know about this. Then the United States. Then Italy. Then Switzerland, then Saudi Arabia, Singapore, Portugal, Greece, and Canada. But Canada's only scoring 1,000 millionaires a year, according to this.
They must be woke millionaires.
They must be woke millionaires. Who the hell would want to move there? So I just thought that would be really interesting because when we're talking about the economy and we're talking about jobs being lost and businesses like the Tigerberg Raceway having to shut down because of a land seizure, an illegal land seizure, there are things that have real-world consequences for us.
Yep.
And we cannot pretend that these are not factors that go into people's thinking every day when they're driving into work. People are evaluating, or if you're catching a taxi into work, you're thinking, is this worth my while?
Mm.
Because it seems to me that if your transport costs you more than you actually get to take home at the end of every month, you would probably do a quick calculation and, you know, you don't have to have a degree in accounting to do this.
Yeah.
Anybody can. And you'd go, cost-benefit analysis. I don't think I'm really going to carry on doing this job. It doesn't pay for me to do this. And for many people, they've given up on that. That's why our unemployment rate is so high.
And now they can just go to Camps Bay, find a nice house, put up a shack, live in luxury.
Yeah, sure.
On someone else's dime.
That sounds good to me. I don't mind living under a tarpaulin if it's in Camps Bay in the summer. I mean, I don't want to be there in the winter, but, you know, that could be a nice holiday home for me. And according to you, all I need to do is just take along my shit and jump over a wall at night.
Yeah. I don't encourage people to do this, by the way. Please don't.
Sounds like you are. Naven Pele says, so all the poor Muslims are going to the UK and the rich Brits are going to the Middle East. How bizarre. Yeah, that is funny, hey?
Yeah.
That is so funny. And ironically, I think certain towns in Britain probably have higher Muslim populations than...
Yeah.
I mean, Dubai is all expatriates. They're about, you know, for every one actual resident of the Emirates, for every one Emirati, you probably get like 200 expats from other countries.
Yeah.
There are a lot of South Africans there, actually.
Yeah, there are.
I've got friends who moved there. They're making lots of money. And they seem to be very happy. I wouldn't want to live in Dubai, but, you know, I can understand the reasons.
Yeah, living in Egypt, I kind of know what it's like to what it would be like to live there under a, you know, Muslim-run country. The only thing is culture, and if you enjoy the culture, if you like the culture, awesome. If you don't, you're not gonna fit in very well.
How did you end up in Egypt? Explain this to me.
So I was born in Texas to parents. My dad is American, Egyptian, Lebanese.
What a mix.
Yeah, and my mom is also Egyptian, French, Greek, and South African.
Okay.
And so when I was 8 years old, my dad got a job opportunity in Egypt. So he took that and we moved there and that was it. And then...
How long were you in Egypt for?
9 years until I was about...
What, in Cairo?
Yeah.
Okay.
Until I was about 18, my parents got a divorce. My mom wanted to come to South Africa to be with family.
What did they do in Egypt, by the way?
My dad was part of a petrol company type of thing. He would travel a lot. He basically made these like raw plastic beads that you put in anything plastic.
Mm-hmm.
And other companies would like buy these beads so they can make like dashboards and cars or plastic bags. So he'd travel around the world to make deals and stuff like that. And
wow. Okay.
Export the
and stuff. Your mom wanted to come back here after they divorced.
Yes, because
and
she's
you were
got family.
You were still at school?
Yeah, I was... going into matric, so yeah.
Okay. And what did you arrive here going?
No, not at all.
No. Okay, so you always
I know Arabic, but yeah.
I mean, you still got the American sound, so yes. clearly that was influential and imprinted itself quite early.
Yes, apparently, a psychologist once told me like children who leave a country before the age of 8 will adapt the new accent of wherever they are, but if they leave a country after 8, the accent stays.
Well, that's why South Africans who move to America are full of shit, if you ask me, because they start, you know, you get these like Afrikaans people from Belleville, and they like get to America, and they're like, "Hi, everybody, I'm Desiree from South Africa." Eh? And you're like, "What a cuck accent!" There is nothing worse. I got to say that there is nothing worse than a South African Afrikaans accent mixed with like a South Midwest kind of, you know.
But I'm told that they have to do that because the Americans don't understand them.
Well, that's...
And it's kind of true because even when I go back, I don't have a very strong American accent. You can kind of hear the twang, but when I go back, some Americans don't understand me. They're like, "What'd you say, boy?" And I'm
like... Well, if anybody goes, "What'd you say, boy?" You get the hell out of there. All right, Gareth, have you seen how the culture in Paris has changed, says Bitcoin Boot? I was last in Paris in, I think it was 2019.
Yeah, that's a while ago.
And yeah, I had. I made the terrible mistake. Look, I had to go there. I wanted to go and see it. I went to Saint-Denis, where the French royal necropolis is. It's where, you know, all the kings of France were buried before the revolution, before France disgraced itself the first time by turning the place upside down. And just emptying all the tombs. And, you know, it was all these the full zeal of the revolution in all its force. And the Cathedral of Saint-Denis is still there. And you know, they eventually tried to kind of patch the whole thing together after the revolution. And it became, again, an important national building. But I went there on my own everybody else wasn't that particularly interested on this trip in going there. And when I got out of the underground in Saint-Denis, which is near the stadium where they did the France World Cup and all the rest of it, it's still the national stadium. In fact, I think they used it for the Olympics too. But when you get out of the underground at Saint-Denis, which is just north of central Paris, you could be in Mogadishu. Mm. It just doesn't feel like Paris.
Yeah.
So yeah, I know what you're talking about, Bitcoin, but it's like if you'd gone to Tigerberg Raceway prior to 2020 and you walked in there now, if you were transported in a time machine and you were suddenly dropped in Tigerberg Raceway 2025 when the last time you'd seen it is 2019, you would have gone, huh?
Yeah.
The hell is this? And if it was improvement, for example, if you were dropped off in a place where they had done urban redevelopment of a kind that opened up public squares and put beautiful buildings up and planted trees, you would think, wow, this is a place that's improving. Mm. This is a good place. People have invested money and time and thought into this. But instead, in both the cases mentioned, those places have deteriorated and become more shit, which is unfortunate because who knows? You know,
lefty policies.
It usually is. Yeah, yep. That's exactly right. Toki says, hello, Gareth and all, from Antananarivo in Madagascar. Okay. Yep. Who watched a Kurt Kaz, that SA dude in Rome who's confronting African street migrants and the NGOs encouraging the invasion of Europe? I haven't seen that, but it sounds pretty interesting. Yonder says, Portugal started their program of attracting millionaires and billionaires 3 years ago. Mm. It's actually a good program, and see how quickly it is showing success. Our fuck twats couldn't even do that. Yonder, there's no need for that language. Yonder and Diggy is very rude this morning, I've got to tell you. But yes, I do remember that because we actually had a company advertise on our show for like a couple of weeks. They were trying to attract South Africans who had had enough of being farmed for tax, which is kind of what happens in this country. And they said, here's an alternative for you. You can go and live in the Algarve, which is one of the most sunny, wonderful parts of Europe. Your tax rates will be much lower. You will be able to buy property there and you could move there. I don't know if that window is still open. I think it might have closed, but still pretty amazing. Okay, let's see here. This another point being made here. I did QC on the toilets when he was Gareth's old beach house. Yeah, I don't own that anymore. So that's not interesting anymore, Slippery Pickle. As I said, I've sold. I don't want any property because I don't think it's a great investment in South Africa right now for all the reasons that Joe is here today.
Sorry,
I don't
guys.
Think those African invaders were ready for a big white SA guy. He wasn't scared at all. What are we talking about here? I don't know what you mean, Gray. I'm not sure. You see, this boring conversation that you guys have in the comment section? I can't read that and have an interesting conversation with Joe. So I can't follow your boring conversation at the same time as we're having a great conversation. You've got to kind of create a context in the comments or else I will. In fact, that's probably a good idea if I just shut that down, right?
No.
I think I'm going to close this tab.
Let them have their boring conversation.
No, I'm closing the tab. Let me ask you about things. How's the comedy business going?
Bit of a slow at the moment because, you know, just had a baby boy. He's 5 months old.
Oh, congratulations. I didn't know about this.
Yeah.
That's quite a big deal.
Yeah. So two kids.
Are you worried that the government will expropriate him without compensation?
No, the government won't be able to take care of him. He's
no,
a troublemaker.
They won't be able to take care of him.
But yeah, so I have a son now and just been, a 5 month old and a toddler.
No sleeping.
They're sleeping, but the days are long and hard, and winter is coming. So yeah, and like I've done a bit of comedy here and there, but yeah, I've been focusing on the family a bit more and stuff like that. So I'll hopefully get back into it soon. But
you know,
yeah.
It takes a brave parent to say that they're having a rough time because most parents don't want to admit that in case they sound like they're bad parents. So
no,
instead they just say,
no. Say, oh, I am a great parent because I'm tired.
Okay.
That's how you should take that. Like I'm putting effort and I'm making sure that, you know, diapers are changed and all that stuff and helping mom when she needs a break and as much as possible. And by the way, I want to give a big shout out to my wife. Some of you might know her as SkyZA on X. She really supported the documentary immensely.
She's terrific.
And she would take the kids.
And she's very outspoken on social media too, which
I love. You've had her post a few times on your show.
let me just give your wife some props here. I haven't met her, but
One day you will, I promise.
But I'm just so impressed at how South Africans who are not media people or journalists or documentary filmmakers or whatever else are starting in their droves to say what they think. Mm-hmm. I just love this. Someone said to me over the weekend, "Oh, how do you just say whatever you think about stuff?" And I'm like, "Well, how else do you know you're free?"
Yeah.
And isn't being a free person on planet Earth in 2025 a major priority for most of us?
Yeah.
Don't you want to exercise that freedom? The first thing you need to do is be able to say what's on your mind.
Exactly.
And people like your wife are saying whatever's on their mind. And that is the point of living in a free country. Living in a free world, being an individual, a sovereign individual, you should be able to say unpopular stuff, popular stuff, stuff that's going to get you into trouble, but you should be able to say it.
Well, I don't even think the stuff my wife says is that controversial. I think what pisses the left off is that she holds a mirror to them and shows how idiotic their way of thinking is a lot of the times. Which is great. And I think that's what people, she often does it sarcastically in a humorous way. I remember there was a recent post where she, you know, that picture of Cyril where he's looking at the, like he tarred the road, but it was like a small section of the road. The rest was dirt. And then she gave like a witty line, like, the GNU's working guys or something like that. And it was brilliant. And, you know, she does that kind of stuff.
I love that.
And
but
it's
you don't have to be out there as some kind of activist.
No.
But I do think there is so much worth laughing about and commenting about. And, you know, when people say, "Oh, you're very brave to make this documentary." Or they say to me, "I'm very brave to say what I say on the show." I'm like, "Well, why aren't you?"
Yeah, exactly.
Because everybody has to pull this horse up the hill.
Exactly.
We're not going to be able to do it on our own. And you can't rely on other people. There's no savior coming. We've all got to do this work.
100%.
It's tough.
And I think any voice, I'm always happy to see someone kind of step out of their shell and then be like, "Okay, I'm going to say how I feel." Even if it's not that controversial, but for them, they feel like, "Ooh, I'm being a little bit controversial." But at the end of the day, you'll be surprised when you start talking about this stuff openly, how many people actually agree with you and what you're saying. I think a lot of people are just in fear.
And a lot of people, Joe, want respect, right?
Yeah.
They want respect from their family, their friends, their neighbors, their community. And one way to get that is to stand for something. You know, you're not always going to agree, by the way. There are lots of people who you and I probably would have different opinions on, which is also okay. But we'll save that for the next hour. We've got some other things to talk about. Apparently, Benjamin Netanyahu has nominated Donald Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize, which has got some heads exploding. We'll talk about that. Plus, who really runs the world? I've got a little chart that will explain how the world is run. And what kinds of governments run the world? Not actual people, but we'll get to that in a short while. All of that and more on the way. Don't go anywhere.